Welcome to another edition of Mycotoxin and Chronic Illness. Today is going to be a real treat. We're going to talk about, I think there are many paths towards healing. And especially when you've had chronic illness, you can often get lost in thinking that it's going to have to be through just physical modalities. And today it's really a pleasure to be speaking with Rave Mehta, a gentleman who has been started off an engineer, inventor, entrepreneur, author, and musician. But what brings him to us today is that he has had the experience of having to go through chronic illness and help. And his experience there, I find very intriguing because it has led him to I think a very creative and exciting way that we can all begin to pursue our own health. So, Rave, would you just give us a little background on who you are and what happened to you? How did you get forced to enter this wonderful journey of healing?
Yeah, so I'm, as you mentioned, I'm an engineer kind of by education. I grew up in a family business where we've been building infrastructure in the US for over 40 years now. Infrastructure being like roads, highways, bridges, airports, rail systems, things like that. And I've, had this, always kind of got trained in the systems thinking approach, from early childhood, because it's a company my dad started and I used to run. And, as I also was super excited about technology, I end up getting into the startup world and doing a bunch of startups, starting with virtual reality and training simulation systems to gaming, and just, all the things that kind of determine human behavior, essentially, so that was kind of my passion. But I've also had this like deep creative energy, that I was always excited about. I loved music. I loved art. I loved film. I loved fashion. I loved any form of art. And, over time, I found that I myself had this kind of creative, artistic energy within myself to express. So I ended up becoming an artist as well. So I had a exhibit up at City Hall in Orlando. I was the city's featured artist back in, 2008, somewhere around there. I'm a pianist as well, as I do these live piano sound bath concerts where I'll play the piano for an hour and people lay down and meditate to these kind of piano meditation concerts. They drop into their flow state, so to speak. I wrote a graphic novel on Nikola Tesla called The Inventor, which is kind of my expression of an inventor, engineer, kind of creative mind trying to bring their ideas into the world despite all odds and all, hurdles. And it's really the story of how anybody who has an idea, whether it's something business related, something mechanical or invention related, something creative or artistic, or even bringing a child into the world, how they could do that and that journey and all the things they have to go through to get there and the mindset and persistence and perseverance that it takes to do it. So that book was a graphic novel. So it's 152 pages of art. And that ended up becoming a bestseller. Scholastic picked it up, and it was the first kind of large graphic novel autobiography on Nikola Tesla and his battle with Thomas Edison and how he changed the world with the power of his mind and imagination. And so that was kind of fun. And then in 2012 rolled around. We were actually looking to make a movie out of that, adapt that to the film. And I was working with a big studio on that. And right before we're ready to sign a production deal, that studio merged with another large studio and everybody in the first studio got fired. All 200 people. Oops. On the film side. So I didn't get to sign that deal soon enough, which was fine. I would have eventually got it done. Just would have taken a couple more months to recycle that. But 2 weeks later, I got Lyme disease and got super sick. And that's when I dropped 30 pounds within a month, had blindness bouts, cramps, anxiety, had all sorts of muscle spasms, just full on nervous system disorder. I couldn't sleep for more than 30 minutes at a time without my adrenals kicking in me into fight or flight and waking me up every 30 minutes on the clock. I had, gosh, that was the physical stuff. And then all of a sudden the neurological stuff would kick in, anxiety, panic attacks, depression, all the things I've never experienced before. And it happened pretty quickly. It wasn't something that built up over time. And it was something that I could definitely tell something was off in my body. It was pretty much like I fell off a cliff. And it was, you know, because some people that have Lyme, it's something that they have chronic and just kind of builds up over time. And they just identify with it as just, you know, kind of part of their sickness. But this was night and day for me. So I spent, you know, 3 months going back and forth between, gosh, hospitals. This was in LA. So it wasn't even in New York or where you would think you'd get Lyme. It was in Los Angeles, where I was living at the time. And I don't remember a tick bite. Apparently 80% of patients don't remember tick bites that do have Lyme, right? So I don't remember how I got it or where I got it, but I spent a lot of time going back and forth between specialists and doing lots of tests, a lot of blood work, a lot of different types of tests, and nothing really showed up significant. 3 months of going back and forth between Cedars-Sinai Hospital and various doctor's offices and specialists. And at the end, the final conclusion of the final person that saw me was that, yeah, we think you have anxiety. Here, let's prescribe some Prozac. And yeah,
that is unfortunately a very common story in this path.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I can imagine it's their catch-all bucket, because if they can't figure it out, then it's got to be mental, and this is how you keep you in the system. So, you know, and that wasn't that person's fault. That's just how the machinery
works.
That's
just what we did. We did that to people with multiple sclerosis 40, 50 years ago. So it's what we do. If we don't understand, if we can't make a clear diagnosis, psychology is our answer, our fallback.
Yeah, it's a catch-all bucket, so to speak.
Yeah.
Right. So I was aware enough that I knew that wasn't the issue, and I didn't take the prescription, but I didn't know what it was. And this is no idea what it was. But meanwhile, it was getting worse and worse. And it really wasn't until, so at that point, I was like, I don't think I'm going to survive 2012. So my last act on this planet was going to be to release this graphic novel that I thought I was going to make a movie off of, but at least get it out there and get it published at Comic-Con. And I had, I convinced a publisher at Comic-Con to let me, you know, release it through them, you know, or at least do a book signing at Comic-Con. And Comic-Con's in San Diego around, you know, early July every year. It's a big convention for comic books and all things entertainment, movies, comics, music. It's about 120,000 people that show up there. So I went there to my book signing. I had 3 days of book signings. I missed the first day. I was too sick. The second day, I was too nervous. I thought all that stimulation would just crush me. And then the third day, my sister showed up and dragged me out of my hotel room and took me there. It's like, you're going to regret this, you know, if you don't do this. So I'm like, okay. So I went there, and there's this long line of people waiting for me to sign my book. Like, wow, people actually cared about this book. So I'm sitting there doing the book signing, and in about 20 minutes, my body feels normal for the first time. You know, people are like expressing their gratitude, their thanks for putting this piece of work or this art, you know, piece of art into the world. And, I was like, wow, this is what it felt like to be healthy. It's been 7 months at that point. This is July, and this started in January of 2012. And about 40 minutes into the book signing, I felt high. I felt like I just went skydiving. I had this adrenaline rush. Everything was vibrant. People looked beautiful again. Life looked amazing. And I was thinking to myself, like, wow, I really want to live. And maybe I could figure out what's happening here and hack this mystery on this to kind of get me, you know, dig myself out of this. So it gave me hope. So that was the first thing. It gave me hope. And and then that set me, kind of shifted my mindset, sent me on this journey, this 4-year journey where I moved back to Florida, where my family was. Spent the next 3.5 to 4 years visiting probably close to 40 or maybe more than 40 alternative health practitioners, scientists, technologists, anyone on the fringe, to learn how they looked at the mind, body, consciousness, how they treat it, you know, what tools they use, what agents they use to, you know, to diagnose and heal. And so I ended up getting certified in a lot of different modalities, from Ayurveda to kinesiology to homeopathy to a bunch of things that people never heard of. You know, I saw a lot of cool technology devices, you know, from voice profiling to discover what microtones, you know, are out of balance, eye scanning, you know, to see what
movements,
movement, not even movements, just little splotches in your eyes that can tell you what imbalances are. Yeah. Obviously, yeah. In Eastern medicine and Ayurveda, we look at the tongue a lot and we look at the face a lot to see what wrinkles, one wrinkle could tell you your liver's off. You know, it's just, I mean, there's so many different expressions that contain our entire system in it, whether it's your fingernails or your tongue, your eyes, your sound, your voice, your blood, that there's so many ways to diagnose what's going on or what's out of balance that we hardly tap into that understanding of that holistic science. And I was able to experience a bunch of different versions of it, which is kind of
cool. That is something I just want to reinforce, is that the plethora of possibility for diagnosis and for healing that, and I just urge people to always remember to not give up hope, because just because we haven't found the answer doesn't mean that it's not there. It just, there's, like you said, there are so many ways to dance with the body and understand it. So, I mean, just keep going, but I just want to really reinforce that, because hope, from what you said in the beginning, hope is the key to triggering healing.
And that, you know, there's a very big universal truth in that statement, because it was hope that opened me up to the potential of me healing myself. And so what happened was, every time I tried something and if it didn't work, I would actually look for something else to inspire hope in me, to keep me going. And that would keep my life force, my prana, my chi up, and my, you know, my energy up, my interest up, my curiosity up, to keep me going until something finally clicked. So it was just a matter of time, and I just needed the engine to keep myself going, motivated. And hope was that engine. That was that motivational engine that kept me going long enough to until stuff started falling into place. And that's just, that was just a matter of time. Just like when you start a business or we're running a startup, you know, the biggest factor is timing. And I mean, you could get capital, you could have the right idea, have the right team, but if the timing is off, then none of it matters. And if you have enough runway until the timing does click, that's when people make, you know, the big wins. So that was, you know, translated perfectly into this. It was, my big win was, you know, healing myself. And I just had to be around long enough for that discovery to come up. And we see this in science all the time, right? You know, you can't solve certain things, and then all of a sudden someone invents some new technology or some new medication or some new you know, tool or diagnostic that allows you to do it. And it's just a matter of time. So as I started doing all these things and, you know, practicing these different modalities, kind of becoming a health practitioner myself, using these tools and modalities to experiment on myself, one of the things that really struck a chord with me, I was talking to a friend who wrote a book on how action adventure athletes, called The Rise of Superman. His name is Stephen Collery, and wrote a book on how action adventure athletes do these superhuman things. They defy death, they break world records, and they do all this by tapping into flow or getting into flow states.
Yeah.
And so we were talking on the phone once, and we were kind of sharing each other's Lyme journeys, and then we started talking about flow. And the one thing he told me that really struck a chord was that, yeah, you know, when we did this research with athletes, we found that novelty is a trigger of flow. And that really struck a chord with me, because it was pretty much aligned with everything that was happening with me. Every time I tried something new, I'd start to feel better. I was incrementally recovering. But then when the novelty were off is when I plateau. So then I tried something new again. Once again, I had hope. I kept re-inspiring hope in myself, like consciously, you know, not accidentally. And like the first time it was accidentally when I was doing the book signing. But then it was like, hey, hope is my engine. So let me keep finding hope in things, possibilities and things. And then every time I try something new again, I get better. And then when the novelty were off, it plateaued. So I realized that novelty was a part of this healing process. So I really got deep into how flow states work. I started experimenting a lot with it. I tried all sorts of different things. And what I discovered is flow states, these peak performance moments where you get up here and you're up here for a minute and then you come down, or an hour, or however long you are, wasn't really what I was looking for, is because I kept dropping down to this very low baseline. And what I was really interested in is getting my fundamental baseline up, my state of flow, so to speak, versus my flow state, my persistent state of flow. And so I discovered a whole bunch of other things and parameters around what gets your baseline up, which really gave me a much larger framework and understanding what flow even is. I mean, we know like some of the mechanics, you know, what neurotransmitters get triggered, you know, whether it's dopamine, epinephrine, or norepinephrine, your anandamide, you know, the things that create focus and what creates the mechanical parts, you know, the results of being in a flow state. But where does it even come from? Like, you know, and we know how to trigger it. We know how you can shift into perceptual state, get hyper present. You know, we know, you know, the challenge to skill ratio. If you have a slightly harder challenge than your skill ratio, that could enable you to get into flow state. Really, what I discovered is flow is finding a wave. It's a rhythm, right? And riding that wave, riding that rhythm as long as you can until something triggers you out of it. But all of that still, you know, to me, it was like, what really is this thing? And to me, I concluded that flow is just life force. It's really accessing life force. And you could do that in a number of ways by getting hyper present. You could do it. It's all tapping into that wave because even life force, everything moves and oscillates, right?
Yeah. But you know, that's, can you, what I want to say is that I'd love you to focus a little bit more on that, because one of the things that's very difficult for people when they get very ill is their energy is low and their brains aren't working well. So they, you know, the idea, so when you're talking about flow initially, they're all thinking, oh my God, I could never go there. But yet what you're now beginning to talk about is something that might be accessible to anyone, because what's difficult is like, I always just like to say is like, you know, it's hard to learn how to swim when you're drowning.
Yeah.
And many people, when you're chronically ill, you feel like you're, you know, once you, to do anything is so much effort. So with that, just tell me more about the connection that you
saw. Yeah, that's a really, really good point, because hope was the first thing that got me. It's really a state of mind. It's the mindset, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all perceptual. And it started with hope, but then it gave me more energy. It's like, you know, in business we say it takes money to make money, right? If you don't have capital, you can't make
fortune.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, not in all cases, but that's
pretty good rule of thumb. Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty good rule of thumb. And in the same degree, it takes flow to get flow. You know, it takes energy to create more energy, and takes, you know, life force to get more life force. So if you don't have enough, then you need to harness what you have until it builds up to a point where you could actually take bigger steps to get more life force. So for me, what I discovered was this: there's five layers to how we access life force. And I'll kind of set up the framework because it'll answer your question a little bit more clearly. The first layer is your body, your physical body. And this is where all the biochemical reactions, the matter, you know, the physical dense matter part of the system resides. It's also the most dense part of the system. And, you know, this is what we study the most, right, in medicine, is the biological, physical body, right, and how those chemical reactions take place and what it triggers. And, you know, that's what the books and stuff that we've seen primarily on recent books on flow states and whatnot is what mechanisms are created within the body to either tap into or keep us in that state. Well, then there's a second layer, which is what I call the energetic body. This is where your meridians are, is what they refer to in Eastern medicine, or your nadis in Ayurveda, also your chakras. So this is where all the kind of the energy channels exist, which powers the physical body. So if you have a specific block in a meridian, then there's not enough flow going or life force going in there. Therefore, that part of the physical body is going to get weaker, and then it'll invite, you know, various pathogens or other biofuel toxins or inflammatory triggers to come in and weaken that part of the body. So that's the second layer, is the meridians or the energetic body. The third layer is the mental emotional body. So this is the body where fear and trust are your two anchors. So if you're in a fear state, then all these negative emotions that I say are rooted in fear will express themselves and then create a meridian block, which will then translate to some kind of biological impact. And if you're in a trust state, you're opening yourself up to more flow. Then you're accessing more flow, which means there'll be more flow pushing or flowing through your body, which will push off any of these physical toxins or inflammatory triggers from, you know, taxing your system, so to speak, your nervous system. So that fear, trust, mental, emotional body, you know, which is really based on fear and trust, fear constrains your ability to access more life force, and trust opens your channels to access more life force or flow. So that plays a big role. And then the layer above that is what I call your perceptual body. This is where your belief systems exist. This is your programming, a lot of it from when you're in childhood, right? So
yeah,
if you have a belief system or your programming, that creates the emotions in a lot of cases without you realizing it. So that determines, that steers you, right? Or steers your day-to-day feelings and thoughts. So that's a bigger body. So each one is getting bigger, but less dense, right? So you have the densest of physical, then less dense your energetic, and then less dense your mental emotional, and then less dense your perceptual. And then this last layer is what I call this layer of universal truths. This is where all truth exists. And also where all flow exists, all life force, infinite ocean of flow. And then what happens is if you have a belief system misaligned with one of these universal truths, you get less flow. And then that generates a fear-based emotion, which creates less flow. And then that creates a meridian block, which creates less flow. And then your body only drops the flow down that channel from this ocean, from which your physical body now has, pathogens, heavy metals, chemicals, food allergens, these physical inflammatory triggers or stressors that will block your flow even more. So in my case, when I had Lyme, I had bacteria, parasites, all of a sudden that created inflammation, which made me sensitive to chemicals, heavy metals, foods, and that kept cycling on itself. So what I had to do at first was reclaim the flow I already had before I got Lyme. And that was through diet, lifestyle, that was through supplements and detoxing, some of these protocols that I used and created to help me detox the inflammatory triggers out of my system so I could stabilize. And then once I stabilized, it was, how do I open up a channel to get more flow from up here, from that fifth layer down? And that's when I started looking at my triggers. Like every time I had an emotional trigger of some kind, I would stop and say, why am I feeling that way? At first, I recognized it was my responsibility. It's always me. It was not somebody else, right? Yeah. So it was something within me that was misaligned. And then I'd backward engineer it in a manner of speaking to figure out where it came from. So I first say, okay, I'm feeling some kind of discomfort. So that's me. What am I feeling? And I just start asking myself, why am I feeling that? What and why, essentially, until I figure out what the story was. Well, I have this story. Well, where did that story come from? And then that I'd regress myself to a point of where I get to the point of origin where that story was, which is where that belief system was set in that fourth layer. And once I could get enough information around that story, it would just essentially numb or dissolve the emotional charge around what that was triggering. And I'd get this aha moment, this perceptual aha. I get it. Oh my God, that's what it was. And that's when I would say I'd pop a truth bubble. So I'd say in this fifth layer, the universal truth layer, all these universal truths we're here to experience as humans are trapped in these bubbles. And each bubble has a certain amount of flow in it. And every time you get a ha moment, you pop that bubble and all that flow goes down to your baseline and increases your baseline flow, level of flow persistently, permanently. So if you experience all the truths, say that, let's assume there's 6,000 universal truths, just to put a number around it to make it comprehensible. If you experience all of them, you pretty much have achieved enlightenment and you exit this matrix, so to speak. And otherwise, the more you experience, the more flow you have, the more you can access and experience more. So it takes flow to get flow. And what I ended up doing was systematically finding my triggers, backward, regressing myself to figure out where they came from, having these perceptual shifts, these aha moments, popping those truth bubbles, increasing my baseline of flow, and doing that over and over again until my immune system actually had enough flow to put myself, until it became asymptomatic, essentially, because my immune system became higher than Lyme. Put itself on top of it so it could manage it better versus Lyme overwhelming my immune system. So it was really through this process. I mean, obviously I continued to detox and do the stuff I could on the physical level, but the thing that pushed me over the edge was that. And I could tell you how, what are those things I did, essentially. That's kind of an interesting, fun story too.
That's important. What I want to point out to people is that the dance is often personal in the sense that what works for one of us can guide, but it's not necessarily going to be the same because we just hear differently and we move differently to information, and our belief systems are much different, just like our immune systems are much different. I mean, that I think is what people have to understand, is that chronic illness, and I think I probably say this every time in each one of these episodes, this phrase will come in there, is chronic illness is a disease of you. It's your individuality that is being expressed. Acute illness usually has a lot to do with the trigger of the event. But once it becomes chronic, once it's with you for 6 months, 8 months, a year, Now we're dealing with the dance that you're immune, your physical, energetic, emotional, perceptual body. That's the story that it is making, and that's where the work really is. Healers, doctors, we can guide, but it's that internal thing that's really going to bring you to health. And that's the beauty of the work that you are teaching us today, is that it's restoring that individual responsibility in a very open manner. That's the part that I'm really hearing from you, is that there's not one way to do this. It's just, but awareness and following that is really important. But so what are the steps that you did, though, with that caveat in mind?
So I guess what I was sharing was kind of the mechanic, like a framework of the mechanics of what happens, between these layers, and how you engage each of those layers. It's very novel and custom to the person, right? So for me, for example, for me to tap into flow, I play the piano. And, the more I played the piano, the better I felt, because it was bringing me present. It was, something about the music and just kind of not having, there's a lot of more nuances in the framework I was telling you about, but not having expectations, allowing yourself to just kind of be open and free. Freedom is, there are these things that trigger what I call a more persistent state of flow versus acute state of flow, the flow state, the peak performance modes, but more persistent. Curiosity is one of those things, being present, but you can't be present all the time. But you could be curious, you could be compassionate, selfless acts, humility, gratitude. Like, those things are actually more permanent triggers of flow. So when I was playing the piano, I just sit there and just play. No expectations, no one to please. I was just grateful that I had fingers and, keys to strike. And I would just feel better. So the more I did that, I realized, wow, maybe there's something around music, at least for me, it was music that could help me get better. So I put a show together to experiment with this. I put a show together called Flow, which was like yoga mixed with Cirque du Soleil to my piano concert. So I pulled a cast together of like 14 aerialist acrobats, dancers, musicians, singers, and composed a show that turned yoga into a performance art. It's like a 90-minute off-Broadway show. It was that we performed at performing arts centers, had a very Cirque-like flair to it. And it's a totally new concept. And mind you, I've never done a performance like that, never put a show together like that, especially for a ticketed audience in a public venue like the Orlando Performing Arts Center. So it was all novel for me, but the novelty was fueling me. I was like, oh, this is cool. This is new. There's also a lot of nervousness, like, oh my God, what if I disappoint a bunch of people? But, when you're in the flow, you don't think about that because you're super present. So within about 2.5 months, I went from composed an entire 90-minute new set of, compositions that we would perform to, train pretty much. There's only two experienced performers. Everyone else was kind of new. So train and choreograph them. So it was a fully novel experience, not just for me, but for everybody for the most part. And we did our first performance. It sold out. And it was a hit. And we had 2 standing ovations. It was just something that was like totally unexpected. I remember feeling so full while we were doing our final bow, like not knowing what to do and something like this is something I'd never imagined would happen. And came off of that. And it was the first time I could meditate because my brain settled for the first time. I had so much life force flowing through me that it stabilized my entire body where I could actually meditate. Because before I couldn't meditate anymore because the soft tissue in my brain was just going haywire. It actually, and many times it would send me in the opposite direction, put me in a downward spiral into anxiety and depression if I meditated too long. So I had to use other methods like sound to help relax my brain or focus, like I have to focus on a task to get myself present, but sitting like a seated meditation wasn't helpful. So then we did a 3-month run of this. And by the end of that 3-month run, I remember the final bow, November 7th in 2015, that's when I realized I was asymptomatic from Lyme. And I didn't have any more symptoms. And that's why I moved back to the West Coast to continue where I left off in life. But in that process, I found that music like the playing the music, and I improvised half of those shows in terms of the music, and the other half was framed, you know, for the performers to know what the cues were. But bringing the audience into the flow, because what I did is I'd have them do these exercises with me before we started. I'd have them breathe with me so we're synchronized. I'd have them do a giant om in a theta with me so we're harmonized. I'd have them close their eyes and meditate for a minute just so they're all present. And that created this connection. And then that connection fueled my improvisation. It kind of fueled my composition or informed it. And then that informed the performers, and the performers were received by the audience, and we created a group flow dynamic that way in that setting in a live show performance format. And that was really cool. And that feedback loop was amplifying the amount of life force, the amount of flow I was receiving.
Yeah.
And that's what I think accelerated my recovery within.
What I find so intriguing about that, and I think it has something to, I mean, it has a lot to do with who you are as a being, but also as some of this process is that, you know, because we see so many people, you know, you think of so many actors and comedians who need that moment, but can't really eat it. You know, I mean, like they it's like chocolate to them rather than sustaining food. If you know what I'm saying, like they go out there, they perform, they feel alive and well, but as soon as the applause stops, oh God, hold on, oops, a fraction of a moment here, technical difficulties, but
it
and flow, no, we just don't want to, we don't want to, have the power go off in the middle. Okay. So there'll be a little, okay. But you know, but that's thing that, that's what really intrigues me is that you, and from the first time I heard your story is that you were able to eat this as real nourishment rather than as just ego enhancement or reducing the pain transiently. And do you have any insight into that? I mean, have you ever thought about that versus, you know, because I'm sure you've seen lots of performers who are in that state. They live for the moment they're on stage, and then they're kind of half dead afterwards. And that's where I think a lot of the alcoholism and drug abuse comes in the performing industry, because they somehow, they don't sustain it. They don't let it feed them.
Right. No, you're right. So, I mean, the digestibility of accessing, tapping into flow and absorbing it and receive, you know, like digesting that flow, so it actually has a persistent effect on your physiology and your body, your mind and spirit. You know, that has a lot to do with that third layer, that mental emotional layer, right? So the mental emotional layer is that fear and trust layer. So with me, because this wasn't my line of business, this was something novel and new and kind of like a fun, playful project that I was experimenting with. I wasn't basing my livelihood or my identity on this thing. It was purely experimental. It allowed me to stay present and just enjoy, like I'm playing in a sandbox. And, you know, when kids play, they're usually present. And when they leave the playground, you know, they're doing something else, but their identity has nothing to do. They're not thinking about what they were doing on the playground. They're just moved on to the next thing. Where a lot of the performer people in the performance industry or the film industry and the entertainment industry, you know, there's a lot of, expectations set around how this defines them. Like, this is my identity. And if this doesn't work or I don't get received well or, you know, whatnot, then my being is resultantly is less. You know, there's some correlation to their being, which they correlate to their identity, which they correlate to their work. And, you know, that's not true in just entertainment. That's true in anyone, hedge fund, you know, performers.
Doesn't matter what you do.
And yeah, whatever. Yeah. The close coupling of identity to the work ends up triggering these expectations and attachments that are counterproductive. So I spent
it constricts the flow. I mean, I can just feel it in the body. It's like you have a corset on instead of having an open system.
Right.
That's very thank you. That's a very I hadn't thought of it that way, but that makes perfect sense. Too much identification.
Yeah, I'll expand on that a little bit because it's interesting. I spent 15 years researching fear. And one of the things I came up with, so when I researched fear, I'd jump out of planes, swim with sharks, I'd do all these crazy things just to understand the difference in what I was thinking and how I felt when I was safe compared to when I felt like when I was in danger. And I identify these three pillars of fear. The first is time. So I found that if I'm, fear always exists in the future. It's what if this happens? What if that happens? A lot of times it's triggered by the past, but always experienced in the present, right? So I found if I brought myself present, then that first pillar of fear will go away. There's no room for fear to exist if you're present.
Right.
The second pillar I found is like but you can't always be in the present. You got to plan for the future. You got to do things sometimes and put yourself in the future. And it's fun to be in the future sometimes. So if you're out of the present, then the next pillar was attachment. I found that, we have attachments to things, whether it's a person, place, thing, object, ideal, or some future version of ourselves. And if we have, the attachment's not the problem. We need attachments. Those are essentially relationships, and we need relationships to grow. There's the feedback loops to help us identify and understand and grow. But the nature of the attachment was varies, right? So you can have a very rigid attachment, like connecting you rigidly to this, in this case, your identity or this version of your identity. And you could have, if there's stresses on both you and this attachment, the forces in life push and pull on you, you and this object of your attachment, then it creates stress in that beam. And then if there's enough opposite forces, they'll snap that beam, slingshot away from each other. And then it was a miserable experience because the whole thing was stressful. Where if you shift that attachment to what I call a orbital attachment, where you use gravity to keep these things in your orbit, and if these life forces push on you, they'll just move you around each other's orbit. There's no stress in the system. And the difference between the two is letting go, essentially. So instead of when I'm in a rigid attachment, I'm focusing on the object and what I want that to look like and be, how I want it to perform relative to me. But if I reverse that and I let go of that and focus on me, what I want to be, what I want to become and whatnot, or my growth, my own growth, things that make me joyful and happy, then the right things will gravitate in and the wrong things will move away and everything will just stay in a natural state based on your own resonance and without any effort. So it's completely effortless, completely flexible. So just that mindset shift of letting go.
I like what you were saying. So it's really focusing on the blessing of your own joy. Mm-hmm. That's something that, again, that's not really how we often think of things in this culture. We often think of things how we're going to make somebody else happy and how we're going to do the right thing. And it's almost like we don't trust that we can depend that our own joy is okay.
Exactly. Right. And when you're in joy, you're present. Joy by actual definition is presence, right? So when you're experiencing joy, you're present, therefore it goes to the first pillar, you get rid of the first pillar. That's exactly right. Pleasure and joy, are the ultimate experiences of presence and ultimate expressions of presence, right? And then, and also it makes you feel more connected. And the, another word for flow, when I think of flow is connection, is feeling connected, right? And that happens when you feel present. And then this third pillar is kind of a attachment to specific outcomes, a very special case, but an attachment to specific outcome, which we call expectations, right? So we have this like formed idea of what we want this goal to, how this goal to manifest. It's like, I want to be the number one comedian in the world, or, in the context of entertainment, I want to sell out this, this theater. We have these expectations, but these expectations are based on these goals and the goals are based on intentions. And if you don't have alignment between the intention and the goal, then the expectations will always be off. But even if you have an expectation, what you need some kind of something to anchor and pull you forward, propel you towards something. But what I found is if I shifted my expectation to a preference, it opened me up to so much more energy. Because if I had an expectation and I didn't meet it, there's no real joy that's gained because you expected it. But if you didn't, there's a lot of disappointment. It's only down, there's mostly downside. Right. But if I shifted it to a preference, it's just a subtle mindset shift. I prefer this outcome, but I'm open to other outcomes. Then if you achieve it, there's a lot more joy, which then brings you back to presence. And if you don't achieve it, it's not the end of the world. There's still other ways that the universe and other things that could enter the system to still serve that goal, or even more importantly, serve that intention that you just haven't thought of.
And that allows the serendipity of life to be in. You can be more interactive with whatever is being presented to you,
right?
Yeah, because you'll actually have the space to notice that something different has happened.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Rather than, I didn't get it, and that's all you can think of.
Right. That's exactly right. And I think they all loop around, because then that once again brings you to being present, right? So you're, so it's all connected. If you take down any one of the three pillars, fear goes away. And if you take away fear, you stop constraining your flow. You move into a state of trust. So now it opens you up to more flow. So fear was the number one thing I found that was the biggest flow life force constrainer. And anything that moves you out of these fear states or expressions of fear, whether it's jealousy, anger, you know, sadness, depression, any of these, any negative emotion, that's, you know, essentially all negative emotions rooted in fear. So any negative emotion, if you can move from there to a state of trust, which are all positive emotions like gratitude, humility, courage, joy, happiness, hope, you know, those are expansive emotions that expand your pipeline to access more flow. And then the fear and constraining emotions that constrain your pipeline to access more flow. So it goes back to it's perceptual. It's always perceptual.
And it's just, again, an interesting thing is how many people who I know who are very, you know, who are very aware of the energetic levels feel that, and we see this actually, that the bugs, you know, the different from mycotoxins, which really isn't alive, but has, is a messenger of something that was alive. And, you know, Babesia, Bartonella, Lyme, they actually produce emotional states in us that aren't ours.
Right.
And when you're ill, that over-identification with that state keeps you absolutely locked down. And it doesn't allow to enter this, to be even imagine that you can enter any expanded state. And, you know, so, and it's not even yours, because yours, I mean, I just love this concept. You know, yours is the opportunity. Gratitude and joy is something that we should be able to access. We should, that we can access at any moment. If
exactly.
If we can put down our stories, but not so easy when we're suffering. I mean, to be fair, that's what I said before. These are wonderful things, but you know, when you're drowning in the midst of your pain, it takes a lot of will, I think. I would imagine to be, or something has to transform.
I'll say what happens, what I've noticed, and you're 100% right. It's what I think there's a universal mechanism that's built into us that it takes letting go and surrendering, right? Yeah. And your body, the universe will somehow weaken you so much to the point where you have no choice left but to let go and surrender, and then your body can regenerate. Because for me, I had such big ambitions, had so much energy, so much flow, had so many ideas. I had a very specific identity. I was trying to, my identity goal was so big and unending. It was something I would never reach. It would be perpetually, it was never enough for me. There's this big identity hole that I was trying to, this void that I was trying to fill. And I was doing so many things successfully, but unless I hit a brick wall and fell to a point where I had no more energy to hold on to that ambition, I would never have seen what it was. And it was essentially this perpetual mouse wheel.
Right.
Going,
you never would have eaten the applause.
Exactly. Right. I was running to stand. I was basically running to stand still. And when I hit that brick wall, it forced me to let go of everything. And that's when everything became clear, and it realigned me and allowed me to grow at a much, you know, physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually at a much higher state than I could have ever done if I continued to be healthy in that state. So I think surrender and letting go is the act of surrender. And that's ultimately where we all lead, which then leads us to humility and gratitude, right? And then gratitude is the highest expression of, one of the highest expressions of truth, of trust.
Yeah. You know, what this reminds me, I always say, and I think I have failed it, I want to learn from the finger of the Lord rather than the 2x4. And, you know, unfortunately, most of us require the 2x4. That's why I think people always talk about the incredible regenerative nature of loss and illness. You know, though none of us want that. We want to get it. I would much rather attain this by listening to what you're saying and acting on it in life than having to go through That dark night, I mean, it truly is a dark night of the soul, that what you had to go through and what people who have chronic illness have to go through. But what's wonderful is to see that how well you've laid out the path, because I love this because it's accessible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, when you say that, it's interesting. What I've found is people learn through two methods. Most things in the world are binary because of this duality system that we live in, right? So you either learn through pain or you learn through awareness. And sometimes it takes enough pain to develop awareness, but once you get enough awareness, you can start leveraging awareness to gain more awareness without the pain. But ever since we're, you know, a baby, right? Until we hit a wall or fall on the ground, we know not to do that again because we have the pain feedback loop.
Right.
But you don't have to use pain for eternity. Sometimes we need enough pain to create boundaries that we could then expand from. And then awareness is what expands our boundaries. So you just need a starting point. And that's where that feedback loop of pain is.
Right. And just getting more aware. I mean, that awareness is the thing, because you don't, that way you don't have to, touch the stove. You just get close. Exactly. You feel the heat.
Yeah, exactly. That's the awareness. That's the awareness.
Yes.
But you knew at some point that if you touched the stove, something must have burned you to know not to touch the stove to show about that reaction. That's why kids do touch, eat everything just to know how it makes them feel, so they discover their boundaries. But at some point when you've done it, you now, the awareness will tell you, don't do that again or do it differently. Right.
So hopefully hopefully do it differently. But so just going back, the flow of the music, I mean, because for you, music seemed to have been, you know, that, I don't know, I don't want to say magic, but that strongest, that really strong piece of this. How do you see that flow going through your life? I mean, was music very important to you when you were younger?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what I did is, after I did my live stage show, the one that had a cast of 14 people, and we had these big performing arts center gigs, and we had audiences that would observe and enjoy the show. It was an external stimulation, you know, for the audience. I realized that I couldn't really carry that cast everywhere I wanted to every time I felt like I wanted to play. So, you know, because it's a big management effort. You got to book it. You got to commit to it. You got to know you're going to be available. You got to make sure everyone else is available. Unless you're on a tour with a committed, you know, crew, but these people had day jobs. I mean, some were lawyers, some were yoga teachers, some were, you know, it was, you know, this was something we did together as something that'd be fun and new and creative. So what I ended up doing was inverting my show, and I called it Flow the Experience, which was where I do these piano sound baths where it's only me. I would show up, I'd do performances here in San Francisco at Grace Cathedral and all around the country, and did a bunch of international shows as well, where I'll show up, I play for about 45 minutes to an hour, people lay down around my piano, and then they just drop into meditative flow state during that time, like almost like an extended Shavasana and the yoga to my music. And I improvised every show. So I never knew what I was playing until I sat at the piano and felt the energy of everybody around me. And then their dropping in was my feedback loop for me to drop into flow. Because for me to play and improvise that long of a set, I had to be hyper-present the entire time. And so that was my mechanism to continue to heal and also now express and use music as a medium of my energy to help heal others. And the information and the feedback I would receive after a lot of these concerts would be, you know, tend to be one of four buckets. One is they got the deepest sleep they've ever had, and these are people that can't sleep. So it finally got to the point where they got to get a deep sleep. Another bucket was, wow, I felt like I was dancing across a cosmos, like they're on some psychedelic, or brought them back to some psychedelic experience they may have had in the past. You know, or some memory, or some, like, you know, someone told me their cat passed away. They relived their entire life with their cat during that time. Or, you know, someone, you know, the third bucket would be this emotional trauma release. That a person tell me that they realized that they just let go of 15 years of trauma from their father passing away during that experience. And then this fourth bucket is some physiological change, shift, or pain going away, or symptoms going away from some disease. So remember a woman that had a shoulder surgery, and the pain was so intense that was the first time after the sound bath that she never didn't feel pain from that shoulder anymore. And I've had people come to me and say, hey, well, I've had this disease or symptom or whatever for, you know, 10 years or so. And for the first time, it's gone. And, you know, so a whole variety of physical illnesses, ailments, and, you know, diseases all of a sudden relieve themselves or release itself. And it was interesting to hear all these stories. And I found the correlation was they were just accessing so much flow that is moving and pushing things around their body and their minds that allowed to flush a lot of things out that were stuck. And doing that together exponentialized was a compounding effect for everybody to drop in and feel it, you know, and feed off each other's energy to drop in deeper.
Oh, yeah. Now, you know, what's that line from the Gnostic gospel? You know, two or three or more are gathered in my name. You know, I mean, just I think that's why people go to sports events and concerts but those are not aimed, you know, I mean, like, they're big energy, but they don't necessarily move us in the direction of health. They just, it's a little bit like the stand-up comic. He gets the applause and it feels really good in the moment, but it doesn't necessarily feed the body, you know?
Yeah.
And what sounds like what your ability to tune in to just the energy, just presence, is helping engender that and entrain that in the rest of the people. I mean, and it's so cool, that feedback loop. I mean, I'm sure you've noticed that depending on where you were, your energy was different.
Oh yeah, and it's different every time. And what I've noticed is what I'm really enabling people to do is going back to what we were talking earlier, is to let go. And I'm using the music to help them let go, because the first 10 minutes or 15 minutes, they're probably still thinking and, you know, doing things. But at some point, the music takes over to the point where they just all of a sudden drop everything. And they're now just gone. It's almost like, you know, doing plant medicine and, you know, experiences, where at some point you don't have the energy to continue to analyze and you just stop, and then your mind stops and everything drops, and now you drop in. And then when you let go is when all the magic happens, right? That's the surrender, is when your body allows itself to reshift and reorganize itself into its most optimal state, you know, given the amount of time.
That frontal cortex stops being in a conversation with what we call your limbic system, and that's exactly. The only thing you know is, how are we going to be smarter at survival?
Right, exactly.
Instead of just being is, you know, I have to say, I guess there's something about our culture, and, you know, I'm never certain if it's culture or toxin load that's made just being so hard, you know, in this time in our universe or in our world, you know, in America.
I would say both. One's a feedback loop for the other, right? You know, I think culture is, I mean, they're two sides of the same coin, right? The not toxins, but just the things we develop. Toxins are a result of human progress, the way we perceive it, right? So if we, you know, we need to, like, create more food, then we genetically modified them, and now we have pesticides that are invading all our systems for the idea of helping the greater good, so to speak. But that doesn't always work. In fact, it does the opposite in a lot of cases. Yeah. So human development and growth of this, you know, human race and species has side effects, and these side effects are toxins. And then the toxins in that human growth or that species development reinforces culture. You know, so the opposite of it is, like, staying, you know, as indigenous people, you know, would not scale as well, right? So there's some balance between the two. Making sure we're in alignment with nature and natural systems while we can still continue to grow and expand our potential as a species. You know, we wouldn't be, you know, landing rockets, you know, like SpaceX does, you know, and going to the Mars, whatever, if we stayed indigenous. But we could also not go all the way to the other side and just assume that, oh, any kind of technology is going to benefit humanity. That's not true either.
Oh, yeah. The technological fix, because that is really the curse of our lives, is that so many people, especially in my generation, really think that we can fix anything, you know? And no, you know, I mean, I think we're coming up to the limits of what we can, you know, we can do workarounds. But if we absolutely forget that we live, that what makes us joyful and alive is connection, then we have to keep going back to connection and not just fixing, because fixing is linear, you know? I mean, we're great engineers. That's how it's funny how well our minds adapt to the engineering model of life. Mm-hmm. But, but indigenous people tend to live in a much more rhythmic sense of life. And somehow the engineering part seems to just have become so dominant that, I mean, that's where my brain is stuck most of the time. You know, you come in, I want to fix it rather than see where it can be held. You know, I guess that's what women always complain, is that us men want to just fix problems rather than just listen.
Yeah.
And
listening is fixing, you know, heart-centered listening is
one of the biggest. That's a hard lesson for those of us who just want to.
I'd agree. That's because we're trained that way from our educational institutions, right? We're trained to fix things, to solve problems, right? Yes. We're not trained to be. Yeah, we're not, you know, if you go back to the technology argument, you know, I'm a big fan of both sides, indigenous and nature-based, you know, civilizations as well as advanced civilizations. And, you know, but it's a matter of technology, but I would say that, you know, being a fan of advancing technology, I'd say what's missed though is the most advanced technology that exists on this planet is our human bodies and minds. And this thing this vehicle that we're possessing and running around in, is far more advanced than anything we've ever created or will be able to create in the next, you know, set of centuries or millennia. So if we start ignoring this thing, this technology that's already has all the built-in sensors and feedback loops in there, then we're missing the boat here. We're thinking we're enhancing this, where in fact this machine can already do so much that we haven't even tapped into yet.
Yeah. And, that's where we get stuck, because we forget. What we can do scientifically is we can be scientific and very good at it if it's something we create.
Yeah.
But when something that is in nature, the best we get are interesting stories about how it works. I mean, that is, you know, as you experienced when you did your journey going through all the various healing modalities, each one has a beautiful story attached to it, as does, you know, Western conventional medicine. We have a story. The thing is, they're all stories. They're our best approximations. And if we hold them gently, we can use them. But when we get rigid and think it's like building a bridge, we don't do so well. And, you know, but it just keeps coming back down to honor the physical body, but, you know, remember the music.
Yeah.
You know, because we just don't do that now. I mean, really, the first thing that goes in school is art and music education. Mm-hmm. Waste of time.
Yeah.
And journey is a great example of how this is what it means to be alive. You know, it's our creative natures.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's the culture we should be nurturing, is the creative potential of us. And, you know, even bridges are designed to have flexibility in it, otherwise they don't work. You know, coming from somebody that builds bridges, like, we have to design, you know, different anchor points to make sure the whole bridge has flexibility, because there's so many different forces pushing on in all directions. So an inflexible bridge breaks and flexible bridges stay. So yeah, flexibility is, you know, it goes back to that attachment, second pillar attachment, going from rigid to orbital, flexible, you know, that's important in all things.
Yeah. And I have to be careful, because I was about to enter into the world of politics, but I'm not going there. Okay.
Well, that'll be another 2 hours.
Yeah, no, and maybe not for this one. But I would just wrap it up with, I mean, I just want to hear a little bit more. How can people learn more about what you have done and how you look at the world and healing?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I haven't formally put myself out there as a platform around this. I've helped people. I've been approached by people. You know, I'll just say my Twitter is, and my Instagram and my Facebook are all at Rave Meta, or RAVEMEHTA, Rave Meta. You message me in any one of those platforms. I am writing a book on this, on all of this, a trilogy, in fact, from fear to flow to perception. So that is in the works. My piano sound baths, I do, you know, that's also, once again, you can find me on Facebook and
those are, some of them are available and really, really worth listening to. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. They're on SoundCloud. They're on, I recently became a teacher for Insight Timer. So some of my sound baths are on the meditation app called Insight Timer. So you can find some of them there. But I'm actually actively now working towards organizing this into something more formal and accessible and hopefully helpful to a larger audience. So that's my goal for this year after COVID.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think hopefully for today, I mean, this is just an inspiration for people to, most importantly, never give up hope. I know it's so hard. And, you know, one thing that I just want to throw in there, one of the most difficult things, especially in after this year of COVID, year and a half of COVID now, I just want to honor is how difficult it is for people with limited financial resources. Because one of you know, because everything that people try outside of their own selves, and I guess this is probably the message of hope, is that there still is that place in inner quiet and listening to music. And finding that inner inquiry, you know? I mean, just, is it true? I mean, I'm blocking on that nice author who wrote that wonderful book, Is It True? You know, just when you're doing that self-inquiry and, like, you know, you get lost in the anger and the blame and really, is it true? You know, how much is just, we've all contributed, and forgiveness. And so I said, even if you can't afford the next greatest, best therapy, going back inwards and listening to what you've been saying today, I think is a great start. And who knows, might be the source of your healing, you know, better than the next IV therapy.
Thank you for that. Thanks. Thank you. And I think the last thing I would say is, you know, I'd say hope is your bridge to healing, and ultimately when you heal, the thing that happens is, to heal you just have to let go and surrender. And what are you letting go of? Fear, doubt, and judgment.
Yes. Well, I thank you. That works for all of us, whether we're fighting chronic disease or just living life.
Yeah. So, exactly.
Thank you.
That's
thank
universal
you so
law.
Much.
Okay.
A pleasure.
All right.
To
thank
talk
you.
To you.
All right. You too. Thank you, Eric. Bye.